start with, I hope to cover maybe a few topics, and not to do any one in too great length, so we don't end up doing only one thing tonight. But I want to start with the first Rashi in the Torah, and explain it, and then go on to perhaps something else in Bereishis, and then something in Noach. Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak, Torah should have started with the first mitzvah, HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, of sanctifying the new moon. U'matam posach b'Bereishis, and why did it start with Bereishis? To tell us the power of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that he created the world, in case the Goyim would theoretically one day come and question our rights to Eretz Israel and say that we conquered a land that belonged to seven nations, we're a bunch of thieves. We have an answer. Bereishis Bara Elokim, God created the world, he gave it to you temporarily, took it away from you, gave it to us. Start with the question. If the Torah would be a list of mitzvahs after Bereishis, just one mitzvah after another, the question would be a good question. The Torah should have started with the first mitzvah. But the Torah is a conglomeration of mitzvahs and stories, even after Bereishis, even after the first mitzvah. It's all the stories of the Exodus and the stories of what happened in the desert. So if the Torah is a combination of stories and mitzvahs, why is it more logical to start with the first mitzvah than to start with the first story? It seems pretty logical to me to start with the first story. What was the question? Why is it so clear that the Torah should have started with the first mitzvah? Bekitzer, the question is based on the following. It is a fallacy that the Torah contains stories. No such thing. The Torah contains mitzvahs. As the Rambam puts it in Sefer Hilchos Melachim, in Mishneh Torah, what is in the Torah is there to teach you Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. That's what the Torah's purpose is, to teach you love and fear of God. Nothing more and nothing less. And every single thing in the Torah, story, mitzvah, or whatever, somehow can accomplish that. If you don't know how it accomplishes that, right, that's your fault. But it's there. Every single story in the Torah, every single bit of information in the Torah, is there to tell you and teach you a lesson that will bring you closer to God, either in a positive way or fear of God in a negative way. If it doesn't accomplish that, it's not there. There's no interesting tidbits of knowledge in the Torah, just for the sake of knowledge. Example is the following Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Ba'asara mamoros nivra ha'olam. The world was created with 10 utterances. Why so many? God could have created the world with one utterance. Why 10? To teach us that the world is a very important place, and to give reward to the tzaddikim who support and preserve this world, and to give punishment to the wicked who destroy the world. Question always bothered me. How did the Tana know that God could have created the world with one mimer? God could do anything. But God created the world in the most effective way. Maybe God knows that you need 10 mimers to create a world. I don't know. How did the Tana know that God could have done it with one? Maybe that's the way you create worlds. Therefore, in the Avos for Reb Nosson, which is the Brises, the sometimes more verbose version of the Mishnah, it says the question a little bit different, which I think can be understood as the question of our Mishnah. The question is the following: V'chimatzorech leboy olam b'kach. Why do we have to know that? We are not going to create worlds. We don't need, you know, a do-it-yourself kit. How do you create worlds? You should do it with 10 mamoros. What we came into a created world. What do we need to know that information? It's interesting, but that's not Torah. Torah is not just interesting information. It has to teach you something. And if it's not going to teach you something, then it won't be found in the Torah. Find it in a science book. Find it in a history book. But not in the Torah. Torah, the word Torah means horah, to teach, to guide. So the question is, who cares? V'chi matzorich l'boyola b'kach. Why so many? Meaning not why did God need 10, but why do we have to know that it's 10? For all we care, it could be 1. Must be there's a lesson to learn from it, and that's what the Mishnah ends. It keeps the tubs of telling me how important every individual thing is in the world, that God created it individually important with 10 separate utterances to give reward to the righteous and punish the wicked. Similarly, the next Mishnah. Next Mishnah in Pirkei Avos and Perikei says, Asara Doros me Adam v'Av Noach. There are 10 generations that are listed in the Torah in last week's Sedra, between Adam and Noach. And there also, the Avos Rav Nosson interjects, V'chi matzorich l'boy olam v'kach. Who cares? It's nice, interesting in historical information. What's it doing in the Torah? The Torah is not historical information. The Torah is that which teaches and guides you. So why do I have to know about these 10 generations? Says the Mishnah, no, it tells me something. It tells me how patient God is, that all these 10 generations angered him, and he didn't bring the flood until 10 generations later. It teaches me love of God, how benevolent he is. The Rabbeinu Yonah says it also teaches me fear of God, because after 10 generations he destroyed them and brought the flood. So God's patience wears out at some point. He has a certain amount of patience. After that, he punishes who's supposed to get punished. So there's a reason. Then the next mission. Asara Doros mi Noach and Avram. This coming week said. There are 10 generations listed in the Torah from Noach to Avram. And there also, the officer of Nosson says, V'chi matzorich l'boy olam b'kach. Who cares? What do we need to know that for? It's interesting information, but what's it doing in the Torah? To teach me another lesson. That many people can exist and not fulfill their purpose, and one person can come along and get the reward of all of them because he fulfilled the purpose that all of them were supposed to do. That's Avraham Avinu. This is so clear in how the Torah presents these 20 generations, in my estimation, in the following way. Last week's Sedra, the Torah lists 10 generations. There are 3 sentences regarding each of the 10 generations. The first sentence tells me who the major person of that generation was, how long he lived before he had his first major child, and then he lived after that and had other children. And the third sentence is, and he lived total and died. 3 sentences about each generation. You would expect, since the Torah has one author, right, that it should be parallel. Now we have a second list of 10 generations between Noach and Avram. It should be the same thing. It's not. In this week's Sedra, there's only 2 sentences about each generation. It introduces who the major person of the generation was, how long he lived when he had his major child, how long he lived after that and had other children, and then goes on to the next generation. It doesn't tell me the total of his life and that he died. Doesn't mention he died at all. It just goes on to the next generation. So there's only 2 sentences about each generation in this week's Sedra, and 3 sentences about each generation in last week's Sedra. Why? The Bible critics go crazy over this. You see, it's 2 different authors, 2 different styles. But according to what I'm telling you, the answer is simple. The Torah only wrote these 10 generations to teach me a lesson. What's the lesson of the first 10 generations? That God is patient and he doesn't punish people until 10 generations, and after that he patience wears out. In order to know that lesson well, what do I have to know? I have to know these people lived. I have to know they lived a long time, and I have to know that they died peacefully in their bed and weren't killed. Otherwise I can't really learn the lesson. Otherwise, I don't know. Maybe they died, you know, in traffic accidents. How do I know how they died? Right? Maybe they died tragically. But if the Torah tells me they lived to be 800, 700, 900 years and died, that means they died peacefully in their bed. And I learned that lesson, that God is very patient and very benevolent and didn't punish these people for 10 generations. So therefore, I need 3 sentences. Who they were, how long they lived, they had a lot of children, and they died peacefully in their bed. What about the second 10 generations? What's the lesson there? A different lesson. That a lot of people can live, not fulfill their purpose, and one person can come and get the reward for all of them. What do I have to know to learn that lesson? That there were a lot of people, right? and that there was one person who received all their reward. Do I have to know they died? No. Do I have to know how old they were when they died? No. It's not part of the lesson. The lesson was only there were a lot of people and they didn't fulfill their purpose. So in the second 10 generations, it is not important to let me know that they died. So it doesn't. Since the whole purpose the Torah wrote these 10 generations was to teach me that lesson, whatever I need to learn that lesson is written. Whatever is not needed isn't written, even though it's a nice, interesting bit of information. But the Torah does not relay information. The Torah gives you Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. Whatever needed for that is there. Whatever's not needed for that is not there. And if it's there, then you somehow you can learn something from it. That is the idea. Comes out that every single thing in the Torah is a mitzvah. There are no stories. There are just mitzvahs that are clothed in stories and mitzvahs that are openly mitzvahs. The Zohar says the stories of the Torah are mitzvahs clothed in stories. In fact, the Ramban says whenever the word Torah is used specific, not to be general everything that's in the Torah, but a specific part where it says Torah, va-mitzvah, va-chukim, va-mishpatim. So Torah can't mean everything because it lists other things. So what is the specific part of Torah that's called Torah? The story part of the Torah. But that doesn't make sense, because the word Torah means to show, to guide, to teach. If anything, the story part is not like that. The answer is it is. Every story the Torah says, somehow there's something that you can learn to get closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, something that will guide your life in this world and the next world. So the stories are merely mitzvahs clothed in stories. That's Rashi's question. That's Rav Yitzchok's question. When you write a book, one of the rules of creative writing is that within the first few paragraphs of the book, you should know, the reader should know what this book is all about. What's the purpose of this book? Is it a story? Is it fiction? Is it science? Is it history? Whatever it is. The first few paragraphs should introduce the structure, the purpose of the book. If the Torah is a book of mitzvahs, except some mitzvahs are clothed in stories, then the most logical place to start is with the first open mitzvah that was given to the Jewish people. And that sets the pattern for the book. Once I have that, now I can go on to stories and know to understand them in light of mitzvahs. But if the Torah starts with a story, how do I know that it's not just a story? Therefore, the most logical place to start the Torah would be with the first open mitzvah that was given to the Jewish people. Now I've set the pattern. What is this book all about? Now if I encounter stories after that, I'll know to understand them in light of mitzvahs. But if it starts with a story, then it looks like maybe it's only a story. How do I know? That's the question. So what's the answer? The answer is that God wanted to, at the very beginning of the Torah, let us know that we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, in case the Goyim ever come and claim that we are robbers, thieves, we took the land from them, we have an answer. A lot of questions on that. First of all, it doesn't answer the question. Why did the Torah have to start with that? The Torah could have ended with that. It could have been an asterisk at the end of the Torah with a little footnote. By the way, Bereishis Bara Elokim. Why? Because the Torah was given completely 40 years before we entered Eretz Yisrael and conquered it. And even if we would have gone into Eretz Yisrael immediately, it would have taken 14 years to conquer it and divide it up. So no Goyim could have any questions for 14 years after the Torah was given, minimum. It was 54 years. So why did it have to be at the beginning of the Torah? Could have been at the end of the Torah and accomplish the same thing. Secondly, do you really think that that's going to make a difference to the Goyim? Imagine if the Israeli ambassador to the UN gets up tomorrow and he says, look, we've been fighting over this and discussing who this land belongs to, right? Abu Mazen keeps coming and saying it's his land and we say it's our land, but I forgot to say something. Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShamayim Es HaOretz. Right? God created this world, he gave it to the Canaanim, temporarily took it away from you, gave it to us. I don't think that the the plenum in the United Nations, everybody get up and say, oh, why don't you say that before? We sort of saved us a lot of time, and we didn't know that. Right? Oh, if that's the case, sure, it's your land. That's end of the question. I don't think they would have accepted it at all. They wouldn't make any difference to them. Thirdly, when the Gemara says that in history the Canaanim did come and did make that claim to Alexander the Great. He had a world court, not in The Hague, but he had the world court wherever he did in Greece. And the Canaanim brought the Jewish people to this world court and said, we want our land back, and we're going to bring a proof from the Jewish Torah, because in the Jewish Torah it says that it's Eretz Canaan. It's a land of Canaan, and we're Canaan. So they sent an emissary called Gvia ben Psisa to argue the case of Klal Yisrael. And what was his answer? Not Bereishis Baralukim. His answer was, if you're bringing proof from the Torah, then let's use the Torah to answer you. The Torah says that it's Eretz Canaan. Let's assume that's your land. But the Torah also says that Canaan is a slave to his brothers. That means you're our slave. Whatever a slave owns belongs to his master. So you own Eretz Israel, but we own you. And we own everything that you own. Not only that, you haven't worked for us for a lot of time. We want back wages. So they ran away, realizing they lost the case. Why didn't he say Bereishis Bara Elokim? The whole purpose of Bereishis was for this purpose. In addition, what do you need the whole Sefer Bereishis for? All the stories of Yosef and the brothers, all you need to know is that God gave the land to Avraham Avinu. Vayelech Lecha, already you know that. Why have Vayerech Haisara told us Vayetze, Vayishlech, Vayeshev, Niketz, Vayigash, Vayechi? Why? And the last question is really the most serious question. And I didn't see anybody who asked this question, surely not who answered it, but I think that what I'm going to tell you is 100% true. The question is, if God was so concerned that we have an answer to the Goyim, of that we're not thieves, that we didn't conquer a land that's not ours and take it, you know, illegally, and because of that, he wrote Sefer Bereishis, okay, as an answer. Why did God give us Eretz Yisrael in such a suspicious way that we need an answer? He could have given us Eretz Yisrael in a much more innocent way, and we wouldn't have any question. And I could think, if God couldn't think of any ways of doing it, I'd give an advice. I could think of two ways that it could have done naturally. Before the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael, God would send an Ebola, what's it called, Magefa, right? And kill out every single man, woman, and child in Eretz Canaan. Okay? We would come in, God would give us protective suits, okay? And we'd bury all these people, or burn their corpses, or whatever, do them a favor, and we didn't conquer the land from anybody. Nobody was here. Or God could have given them heart attacks, strokes, and every single one would have died. We didn't have to fight them. We didn't have to conquer them. Right? God can do that. So you tell me, well, God doesn't function like that to do such miraculous things. Okay, I got another way that's more b'derech hateva. God could have made the economic situation in Eretz Canaan so bad that all the Canaanim would have picked up, moved to New York to drive cabs and open falafel stores. And that's pretty normal. That's pretty, what's it called? Makes sense. And we would have come into a land where nobody was here. And we just took it over. So nobody has any complaints. We didn't take it from anybody. We didn't conquer it. Why did God give us the land in such a suspicious way, which begs the question, you look like a bunch of thieves, but no Bereishis Bara Elokim, well, we have an answer. Don't beg the question. You don't need an answer. The answer to all these questions is, first of all, the answer is that this is not for the sake of the Goyim. They won't accept it, it's not for them. And the Pasuk says that. Koach Maisav Higid Li Amor. God told us, not them. We have to know we're not thieves. Secondly, the Torah starts from the first mitzvah. So what's Bereishis? Bereishis is not the beginning of the Torah. It's the preface to the Torah. In any good book, as you'll see, right, there's a preface, right? Start page one, right, is the beginning of the book, but there's a preface to the book, which usually is Roman numerals. So Bereishis is the Roman numeral preface, and the beginning of the Torah talk is Hachodesh Hazeh Lachem. So why do you need a preface to the Torah, and why do we have to know that? There's an argument between the Vilna Gaon and the Dubna Magid as to how a person should look at mitzvahs. The Vilna Gaon says, without going into great detail about this, because we mentioned it in the past, I'm just going to mention the idea, not where they learn it from. The Vilna Gaon says that if a mitzvah comes too easily, it's a sign that it's not really a quality mitzvah. Because the Satan's not putting up a fight. He couldn't care less if you do it or not. But if a mitzvah is difficult to do, that means the Satan is concerned that you don't do that mitzvah and he puts up a fight. So a quality mitzvah is represented by the difficulty that it is to do the mitzvah. The Dubna Magid says just the opposite. If a mitzvah is hard to do, it's a sign that it's not God's mitzvah. God's mitzvahs are easy to do. And if it's too hard to do, you're not doing God's mitzvah, you must not be doing it the right way. Completely opposite philosophies. And they were contemporaries, and the Dubna Magid was a Talmud Chaver, he was a student and contemporary and colleague of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon used to call him to give him Musa. It's very difficult to say they had such divergent philosophies. Bottom line, the difference is the following. What the Vilna Gaon is talking about is the following. He's talking about getting the foundation of values and standards that are necessary to be able to fulfill mitzvahs. Before you can fulfill any mitzvahs, you have to have the right outlook on life, the right standards, the right values. If you don't, the mitzvahs are going to be very difficult. If you have standards, values, outlooks, hashkafos that are not Torah, that are secular, and you want to keep the Torah, right, your secular values and outlooks are going to make it very difficult to keep the mitzvahs. Sort of a Hollander, Zatzal, said, he was a rabbi, a young Israel rabbi in America, he was nifter a few years ago. I saw once he said something very, very interesting. He said, people who basically have secular values, secular ideas, but they want to keep the Torah, they want to be frum. They don't have 613 mitzvahs. They have 613 problems. Because every mitzvah conflicts with their way of life. And every mitzvah is a problem. And they have to figure out how they can fit the mitzvah into their way of life, which is not really Torah-dic away. I'll give you an example. You're all familiar with the fact that there are women who feel cheated, discriminated against by none other than God, who didn't give them the ability to put on tefillin and to be a chazan or whatever, and they feel that somehow they were cheated and their relationship with God is compromised because they can't do all these things that men do. Now, what is the motivation of these women? And I'm not foolish to think that the motivation of all of them is the same. But what would it seem like? These women are very spiritual minded. It really bothers them that they don't have that connection with God through tefillin and tzitzis and a talis and being able to be a shliach tzibur. And it bothers them. They're very spiritual minded people, and this really bothers them that they can't create a relationship with God through tefillin, talis, and so on. I find that hard to accept, because that would imply that our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, right, great women of the past who never clamored to put on tefillin or talis, right, were really not so spiritually minded. They were, you know, what's it called, happy to be in the kitchen making their chocolate cakes. They didn't really care about the relationship with God, right? But these women are really special. I find that difficult to accept. Women of previous generations were bigger tzidkonios than women today, as men were. And they for sure had a more greater desire to have a relationship with God. It didn't bother them, though, that they didn't put on tefillin and wear a talis. They had their role to play, and they felt that that's how they get closer to God. So why does it bother women today? Now, the answer is that if I were to ask a secular person, goy, Jew, makes no difference. If I'm a fairy godmother with a magic wand, and I can give you two possibilities. I can transform you into an actress. You'll be famous. The whole world will know who you are. Right? Your name will be a household commodity. And you'll make a certain amount of money or whatever, or have a certain amount of talent. One possibility. Or I can give you a tremendous amount of talent. You will not be the actress on the screen. You will be the person behind the screen who will write these movies, plays, or whatever, direct them. Nobody will know basically who you are. Your name will come on, you know, in the credits afterwards, which nobody looks at, right? But you'll have a lot more talent and you'll make the same money. Which of the two do you think a secular person would choose if they had the choice between the two? I would imagine most of them would choose the first way. Because from a secular standpoint, fame is a value to itself. There's a value to be famous. People like to be famous. Okay? Unless you're running away from the FBI, you would rather not be famous. But otherwise, people like to be famous, to the point where an extreme, absurd example. When I lived in Cleveland about 40-something years ago, there was a murder. Somebody murdered his neighbor, and the police couldn't find a motive. Right? They caught the murderer. He admitted to the murder, but there was no motive. He didn't even know the neighbor. Just walked into his apartment one day and shot him dead. Finally, they got it out of him. Why did he murder the neighbor? Because he wanted to be famous. And he knew that murderers get their picture on the first page of the newspaper, and he wanted to get fame. So he murdered the neighbor to be famous. Fame is a value to itself. From a Torah standpoint, fame is not a value to itself. It may not be something wrong. Sometimes it's beneficial to be famous. But most certainly the value is the less famous you are, the more in the background, the better it is. Ein habracha mitzuya l'bedovra asomim minayin. What's hidden in the background has more bracha. The holiest place in the world was the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, which no one ever saw, except for the Kohen Gadol once a year, and there was a smoke screen, he couldn't see what was in there. Nobody ever did a spread in Better Homes and Gardens on the Holy of Holies. Nobody ever saw it. But that was the holiest place in the world. So Adarav, just the opposite. What is hidden is more important, not what's famous, not what's in the forefront. If you have a Torah philosophy, as our great-great-grandmothers did, the Chazon Ish's mother did, then you can't complain, why didn't God put me in the forefront? Let me be a chazon. Let me put on tefillin, talis. I should get up in the morning, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning and go and daven with a minyan. Nothing to complain about. God enabled me to be in the background, which is a much more important role. But if you have secular values and being in the forefront is a value, then you feel that you've been discriminated against. How come God pushes me in the background when I could be in the forefront? So the problem is that today's women have different values. And because of their values, which are not Torah values, keeping the Torah is difficult. But if you have Torah values, the Torah fits perfectly. It's only men that should complain, not women. So therefore, before you can keep mitzvahs, you have to first establish your value system, your outlook. And that's very difficult. That's what the Vilna Gaon is talking about. If it comes easy, it's a sign that you're not really doing it properly. That comes very difficult, with difficulty. But once you establish the base of your outlook on life, your values, your standards, your goals, and their Torahdik, you have a round base, then the mitzvahs are round, they fit perfectly on it. But if you create a square base from different values and you try to put the round Torah on it, it's not going to fit. So therefore, that's what the idea is. The Torah said, I can't start the Torah with the first mitzvah. I have to start with something more significant as a preface. And that is, how are you going to establish your values, morals, standards? And I'm going to use the following way, the Rabban Shem said. The whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to give us a place where we can establish a society that's built on Torah. Torah values, Torah standards, and mitzvahs. That's what Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be. God says like this, I'm going to give you Eretz Yisrael in a way that in the eyes of the nations of the world, you are a bunch of thieves and murderers. If you establish your morals and values and standards on their terms, then you have no right to Eretz Yisrael, because you're a bunch of thieves in their eyes. According to their standards, you're a bunch of thieves and murderers. But if you choose to establish your morals and standards on me, then in my eyes, you're not thieves or whatever. I told you to conquer the land and to kill these people. I have the right to do that because I gave them life. I can take it away from them too. And I can command you to take it away. So you have a choice. You can establish your values and standards on me or on them. If you establish it on them, you have no claim to this land, and you don't need this land. Because the whole purpose of the land is to establish a society based on God's morals and standards, and you're not doing that. If you base your standards and morals on me, then you have a claim to the land, and you're not murderers, and you're not thieves, and then you can have a Torah. Then you can keep the Torah. So before the first mitzvah could be given, the Rebbe Shlomo first had to establish what are our values and standards. And he did it in a way that forced us to make a decision. If you're going to accept their values and standards, you don't have any claim to this land, you're a bunch of thieves. If you accept my values and standards, you have a claim to the land, you're not thieves, you're not murderers, and then we can start the Torah and give you mitzvahs. Because the mitzvahs have to be based on values and standards that are Torah, not foreign to Torah. Okay. That's, in a nutshell, the idea.